Arya Paryantam Hasmaraj Vande Guru Paramparam.
Very good.
Nice to see you all this evening. We begin our next text in this series of short texts by Shankaracharya. And the next text is Drik Drisha Viveka, very important text. I should mention, it's not always attributed to Shankaracharya. In fact, many of these texts, we're not sure who is the author. In many texts, it's attributed to Sri Shankara. In the commentary I'm using, the commentator actually attributes it to Bharati Tirtha. Bharati Tirtha, some of you know, was the guru of Vidyaranya Swami, very important teacher in this Advaita tradition. Whether or not it's by Shankara or Bharati Tirtha or some other one, it doesn't really make any difference. One thing we know is the style of writing is definitely the style established by Sri Shankaracharya. His style is characterized by the two Sanskrit adjectives, prasanna and gambhirya. Prasanna means it's very pleasant. In fact, in terms of Sanskrit, it's usually fairly easy and simple. Some of his commentaries are not very easy or simple, but generally his teaching is very clear, very straightforward, but at the same time, gambhirya, depth, profundity, both are present. It's easy to write something simple, which is really trivial and insipid. Well, what Shankara wrote is certainly very profound. And in this text is considered a prakarana, an introductory work. And in particular, this text is known as being Tvam Para Vichara Pradhanya. Means that it's primarily focused on an inquiry, vichara, into the Tvam Para. Some of you will remember in our introduction, the very first of the series of classes, we discussed that all of Advaita Vedanta is basically an unfoldment of the Mahavakya, Tat Tvam Asi, which means it's in the understanding of these two padas, these two words, the tvam pada, the word tvam, you, and the tat pada, the word tat, that, he. It's in our inquiry into the meaning of these two words that the teachings are really unfolded. Some prakaranas, prakarana means a short introductory work, some prakaranas are tat para vichara pradhanya, primarily focused on the tat para. Our next text, Panchikarana, is that kind of text. This text, however, Drik Drisha Viveka, is primarily focused on an unfoldment of the tvam para, the ultimate meaning of the word you, which means it's an inquiry into the nature of atma. Atma vichara, self-inquiry. That's really the main topic, not the only topic, but the main topic of this text. And as we continue, I'll be referring from time to time to a commentary. There's really only one commentary that's used on this text. This is a commentary called Vakya Sudha, and it's written by one Brahmananda Bharati as the author. There's not a lot in the commentary that's of great significance, but if there is something, I will definitely bring it out for you. Also, I'll remind you that these texts that we're using are all available on our website, and I highly encourage you to go to our website and print out your own copy and bring that copy to each class. Go to our website. It's freely available there. So, with this very brief introduction, we're ready to begin our text. I think you'll find this is a favorite text of many Vedantins because it's so simple and direct. Every verse follows in a very clear order, logical fashion. It's so The clarity achieved, especially in the opening portion of this text, is something amazing. Let's begin and you'll see what I mean. Repeat after me. Rupam drishyam lochanam drik. Rupam drishyam lochanam drik. Tad drishyam drik tu manasam. Tad drishyam drik tu manasam. Drishyadhivratayasakshi drigevanatudrishyate. Good. The opening of this text is exactly what the title says. Drik. Drishya viveka. Drik becomes drig when it's in a compound. Drik means seer or observer. Drishya means that which is seen, that which is observed. So maybe good translation would then be drik perceiver and drishya perceived. Viveka means a discrimination, an attempt to understand what is what. And this is an attempt to understand what is what. The difference between seer and seen, observer and observed, perceiver and perceived. And at first, this sounds kind of silly. You can't tell the difference between seer and seen. In fact, that's where the problem begins. It's very subtle, and what you'll see is very surprising. It begins with a very obvious premise. Anything observed by you is not you. Simple enough. There, we make a distinction between subject and object. Subject means you, the knowing person. Object means something else, something external, anything known to you. So you are that subject, the perceiver, we'll stay with that word. Anything known to you is perceived. Now, what is perceived? Rupam drishyam. Anything that has form, rupam, is drishyam, seen. Now, this is a reference to what we see with our eyes, but it really extends to all of our five senses. So with regard to our eyes, what is seen is an object. With regard to our ears, anything heard is an object. Remember, you are the perceiver. So with regard to your eyes, anything seen is an object known to you, the perceiver. With regard to your ears, anything heard by you is an object known to you, the perceiver. With regard to your senses of touch, smell, and taste, same thing. Anything perceived by you is an object, some kind of form. It's known by you, the perceiver. You're thinking, this is pretty obvious, don't you think? Is it necessary to start at such a fundamental place? It is necessary. Because one of the... You've probably observed this. I've certainly observed this over the years. One of the biggest problems when people come to a spiritual study, especially a profound spiritual study like Advaita Vedanta, is sometimes people lack the basics and immediately dive into very subtle ideas. I hear people talking about Maya. You will never understand Maya unless you have understood a lot of very important basic teachings leading up to that point. And sometimes people skip over the basics. They think, oh, I know all that. Well, you'll find that a lack of proper understanding of the basics creates a lot of confusion. So we begin with the very basics. Rupam drishyam, anything perceived by you is an object. And in this case, lochanam drik, with reference to a seen object, the drik, the seer, the observer, is lochanam, eyes. So with regard to a seen object, your eyes are the seer. with regard to perceiver, let me say. With regard to sound, your ears are the perceiver. With regard to smell, taste, touch, your other senses are the perceiver. Drik means perceiver. Now, now it gets a little more interesting. That's pretty obvious, I admit. As we continue, though, tadrishyam driktu manasam. Tadrishyam, that is drishyam, that is observed, that is perceived. What is perceived? Whatever your eyes pick up are perceived. Whatever your ears pick up are perceived. Whatever your other senses pick up are perceived. So just as your eyes perceive what's outside, something perceives what your eyes pick up. And that's something, driktu manasam. The observer, drik, of what your eyes pick up is manasam, mind. Now this is the opening of a very important sequence. Let's make sure the sequence is clearly understood. So it begins, would you turn on that light, please? So we begin by saying that a rupa, some form or object, is perceived. Perceived by what? In this case, lochanam, eyes. But then we say whatever is picked up by your eyes, and this stands for any of the five senses, is itself perceived by mind. No, let's put the Sanskrit here. Manas, mind. Manas or manasam have exactly the same meaning. So, whatever is picked up, outside objects are perceived by the eyes. Eyes are perceived by the mind. Drishyaha dhivratayaha. But dhivratayaha, those activities of the mind, dhi-buddhi, mind, just another word for mind here. Dhivratayaha, the actions, the activities of your mind, dhivratayaha, all of them are drishyaha. They are seen, they are observed. Activities of your mind are observed. Observed by whom? And this is where Vedanta really begins. Who is it? We're going to see this in more detail in the next verses, but I just want to make sure that we're getting the profundity of this. This verse is an inquiry into the most fundamental aspect of human existence. How do you experience anything? How do you know anything? How do you know I am sitting here? This is what we're inquiring to. How do you know I'm sitting here? Because your eyes pick up this image. But then how do you know what your eyes pick up? Because your mind is engaged. Whatever is, and I guess this is the right time to go through it briefly. This is just a favorite little bit of science that's helpful to bring in here. You remember how sight works? It's really kind of, I've used this in other classes, but it's fascinating. And it really makes an interesting point. The point that it makes eventually is that you do not see, you do not directly see the Swami sitting in this chair. Absolutely not. You do not directly see the Swami sitting in his chair. Why? Do you remember in a science class when you learned about how eyesight works? It begins with light bouncing off the object, striking your eyes. On the front of your eyes are two lenses. Those lenses focus the image on the retina of your eye, which is in back of the eye. And if you remember, the lenses also invert the image. So what first thing that I find very interesting is right now, on the back of your eyeballs are two quarter-inch tall, upside-down Swamis. Correct? Absolutely correct. On the back of your eyeballs are two quarter-inch tall, upside-down Swamis. Then things get more complicated. As you remember, the retina has all these sensors, the so-called rods and cones, which convert this optical light into optical energy, into nerve impulses. These nerve impulses go from the right eye into the optical cortex and left part of the brain, goes from the left eye to the optical cortex and the right part of your brain. This is getting very confusing. Already, we got two swamis. They're upside down, they're quarter inch tall, and they're backwards because this optical nerve does this crisscross. Is that what you see? Upside down, backwards, quarter inch tall. That's not what you see. So the one that you see, first of all, is not the one that's out here, which is the first step, rupam. Then we come to the next step, lochanam. Your eyes pick up through this very complex process, and the eyes then convey to your brain all these nerve impulses. Is that what you're experiencing right now, nerve impulses? You see me. The me that you're seeing is not out here on the chair. It's in your mind. An image of me has been fashioned in your mind. Now, I went through this process to illustrate. These are three completely different levels. There are objects outside in the world. They are two steps removed. We're actually going to find out three steps removed. They're three steps removed, as you'll see. Because these objects outside in the world, first of all, have to be picked up by these really complex sensors we have, eyes and ears and our other senses. Every one of the senses are incredibly complex, the way that we work. And then even the senses, all they pick up is nerve impulses, right? So those nerve impulses are not what you perceive. Those nerve impulses go to the brain, and through a miracle that no one quite understands fully yet, in spite of the fact that neuroscientists have been studying this for decades, they still don't understand how, as a result of all these inputs to the brain, an image of me is formed in your mind. That's the third step. Three steps so far. And the image of me in your mind is known or unknown? Known, of course. Known to whom? The simple answer is to whoever is seeing it. That person is called sakshi, witness, or observer. So the last step, sakshi, literally means witness. The one who witnesses the activities of the mind. Divrtayaha, the activities of the mind, are all drishyaha, they're all observed. And observed by what? Sakshi drikeva. There is one that witnesses the activities of your mind. That is drik eva. That is the observer of your mind. And that one, drikeva, that observer of your mind, we call here sakshi, witness. Okay. We're describing your experience, right? So we started off the class by observing that this is pretty fundamental stuff, difference between subject and object. Now you know it's not so straightforward. 5 minutes ago, you thought you were looking at me. If you've understood what we've just discussed, you should now conclude that you are not looking at me directly. Rather, you are seeing an image of me in your mind. This is extremely important. That's not exactly how we commonly think, right? And this is what Vedanta does so brilliantly. It challenges our usual conclusions about our experience. We have experiences, normal experiences like sitting here, seeing me sitting here. But we constantly misinterpret our experiences, and this leads to suffering. It's another big topic. We're not going to go there for right now. But just understand that experiences can be misinterpreted. Like this experience. This is me. Of course it is, right? Wait a minute. This is perceived, right? Rupa? Rupa means it's an object. It's an external object. It's out there in the world. This body is known to me through my senses. I can see my body. I can feel my body. Hey, that's way out there. That's rupa, form. How can it be me? After all, I am the sakshi. Anything known is not me. Your physical body is known to you. How about aspects of your sukshma sharira, subtle body, that which enlivens your body? You know, for example, the function of your five senses. Your five senses are knower or known with regard to you, the sakshi. Your five senses are known. Then, how about prana, life force? Do you know when you feel tired? You know you feel tired? Therefore, does tiredness belong to you or belong to the world of the known? Does tiredness belong to the knower, the sakshi, the witness, you, or does tiredness belong to the world of the known, specifically your body? But look at the problem. Say, oh, Swamiji, I'm so tired. I am tired. Look at the language. We do this all the time. It's deeply wired into our minds. We've made this misinterpretation of our experience habitually from childhood onwards. Vedanta, and this text in particular, is going to challenge you to break that habitual misinterpretation of experience. What you experience is not you. You are that sakshi, the observer, the witness. Body is experienced by you, not you. That which enlivens your body, prana, is experienced by you, not you. Thoughts. Whatever you're thinking about right now, whatever is in your mind right now, is it known? It's known. If it's known, it's known to whom? You, the observer, the sakshi, the drik. And if those mental activities, if those thoughts are known, they're not you. And a very important mental activity to consider is emotions. When you feel sad, how do you know you feel sad? You know the presence of sadness in your mind. Is it not so? Of course. You know the presence of sadness in your mind. Therefore, with reference to you, the sakshi, the observer, isn't the sadness external? An external object which is not you? Look at our language. I am sad. I am happy. I am this. I am that. These are the kinds of confusion that we must address. And that's what this chapter, or this text, very powerfully begins by making this distinction. So, let's see where I want to get into the deeper discussion. Okay, we're going to move ahead and then see. So, drishyaha dhivratayaha, all the activities of your mind are known, and known to whom? Sakshi drik eva. Sakshi, witness, is the one who observes. And before we finish this, let's just make sure we understand. What do we mean by sakshi, observer? What is it about your mental activities are known to you? What is it about, what is it that allows you to know your mental activities? This is pretty fundamental stuff. Very deep inquiry into a fundamental reality of experience. Mental activities are known to you. How? What a question. Mental activities are known to you. How? It's not exactly a process. It certainly isn't a very complicated thing. What you would say intuitively is, I just know. I am aware of whatever is happening in my mind. I am conscious of my mental activities. And these expressions are perfect. I am aware of mental activities. I am conscious of whatever is happening in my mind. Wonderful. I am conscious. And as we continue, we're going to finish it up by saying, I am consciousness. I am that consciousness by which all mental activities are known. Sakshi, ultimately, is nothing but consciousness. That Sakshi is you. First, we're going to come to this in three more verses, but just to make it very clear, is there you and Sakshi? Are there two of you inside? Is there someone who knows what's happening in your mind, or you know what's happening in your mind? You know. That's your experience. You don't have the experience of some entity called Sakshi watching whatever is happening in your mind. That's not your experience. Your experience is you are the Sakshi who knows what's happening in your mind. So we begin by, you are that Sakshi, that witness, but then what is the basic nature of that witness? What is required to witness the activity of your mind? And the answer, of course, is consciousness. Now please be careful. We use a Vedantic definition of consciousness. A few of you may have some medical background. The medical definition of consciousness is utterly different from what we use. The medical definition of consciousness has more to do with ability to respond to the environment. If that's your definition, set it aside. That's fine in a hospital. That is not the definition of consciousness we use here. So the definition of consciousness we're using here is the very fundamental nature of you as the observer or witness of all mental activities. Mental activities are known how? Because you are conscious of them. So finally, you are that consciousness by which all mental activities are known. So look at the sequence. Because of consciousness, you know what's happening in your mind. Because you have a mind, you know what your senses pick up. And because you have senses, you know things outside in the world. So the world is three steps removed in terms of our experience. The most direct experience you have is you experience the activities of your own mind. That's a direct experience. Everything else is indirect. Last part of this first verse says, well, there sakshi drikeva, while the you are that witness observer, that which is the observer of all the mental activities, but that is na drishyate, that one is not observed. So you are observing your thoughts. Is there an observer of the observer? Is that your experience? Do you experience yourself observing someone who's observing your thoughts? Is that your experience? That's not our experience. Vedanta is an analysis of our experience. You experience yourself as the observer of your thoughts. Therefore, Drigeva, that Sakshi, is the observer, and Natu Drishyate, but it is not itself observed. The chain comes to an end. We start with the outside world, come down to the senses, come further to the mind, and we end up with Sakshi Chaitanya. Chaitanya means consciousness. Sakshi Chaitanya, witness consciousness. When you reach that point, can you go any further? Is there an observer of the observer? That's not your experience. So this is the opening. What a way to begin a text. This is the opening verse of the text. And we've gone through three levels: the external level of the world outside, the level of our senses. Senses are called indriya in Sanskrit, and then to the level of the mind. The next three verses are going to take up in sequence these three levels. So next verse is on the external world, rupa. Next verse after that is on our senses, indriyas, and the verse after that on manas. So let's proceed and see this continue.
Nila pita stula sukshma, nila pita stula sukshma, hraswa dirghadi bhedataha, hraswa dirghadi bhedata, nana vidhani rupani, nana vidhani, pashye lochanamekadha, pashye.
All right. So the things that we see and experience. We get a shopping list here. Some things we see are nila, blue. Others are pita, yellow. Some things we experience are stula, physical, gross. Some are sukshma, subtle or light. Some things are hraswa, short. Some things are dirgha, long, etc. Adi, etc. Bhedataha. There's distinctions, bheda, difference between all of these. Bhedataha, because of all these differences, because of all the differences we've just discussed, therefore, nana vidhani rupani. Therefore, we experience rupani, various forms. Rupani is plural. We experience forms, rupani. What kinds of forms? Nana vidhani, nana vidha, of many types, of many kinds. We experience forms of many kinds. And again, form isn't limited just to sight. It applies to all the five senses. So anything we experience can be categorized. I guess that's why in English, and in fact, in every language, we have various adjectives, visheshana. If everything looked the same, we wouldn't need adjectives, right? If the only thing that existed in the world were 1-inch cubes that were gray in color and of exactly the same dimension and weight, if everything in the world were nothing but that, we wouldn't need adjectives. We live in a world of infinite complexity. We have all these adjectives that differentiate all the things that we perceive. All of those qualities then, an object will have various qualities, a noun will have adjectives, an object has various qualities, and it's these qualities that are perceived by us. Nana vidhani rupani. How many kinds of variations? Infinite. How many kinds of colors are there? If you get really technical, you can go on infinitely dividing the color chart. There's no limit to the number of colors. How many tastes are there? How many smells are there? How many different kinds of texture are there? Infinite in number, but pashyet lochanam. But lochanam, the eye, and eye here represents all the senses, the eye that pashyet can see, can observe, the senses that can observe, that eye is ekadha. It is one. Now, what's being set up here is a sequence that what is seen is many, but what observes the many is one. Good. One eye, two in this case, observes. One eye will do, actually. With one eye, you can see many, many things. One eye is all that's required. All right. Let's move on to the next verse. So we have these three verses in a sequence. First one dealing with rupa, external forms. Second one now dealing with the five senses.
Andhya mandhya patutveshu, andhya mandhya patutveshu, netra dharmeshu chaikadha, netra dharmeshu chaikadha, sankalpayen manashrotra, sankalpayen manash, twagadhau yojyatamidam, twagadhau yojyatamidam.
This text makes it so simple and clear. So your eyes pick up external things. How do you know that your eyes are involved in the process? Well, this text makes it very near. You know, if you have andhya, blindness, how do you know? That's interesting. You can't say that, oh, I see. By definition, you can't see. So you can't say that I see that I am blind, but rather you're observing your senses. We're now down at the next level. Through your mind, you observe your senses. Therefore, andhya is known to you. Also, mandhya, dullness. Like, do you need these glasses? That's a kind of dullness of the mind and of the eyes, incapacity of the eyes. Or some of you don't need these, and you have sight which is called patu. Patu means very clear, very sharp. So the quality of your eyes, whether you're blind, short-sighted, nearsighted, whether you have astigmatism, or whether you have excellent 20/20 sight, this is known to you. The very function of your eyes is known to you, and that applies to your ears. If we're hard of hearing, what? You figure it out sooner or later, and you know that your ears aren't picking it up very much. So all of these qualities, blindness, weakness, sharpness of the eyes, all of these are netra dharma. All of these are qualities of the eyes. And netra dharma shucha. These are quality of the eyes. How are these qualities known? So just as qualities of objects outside, the qualities are known by our eyes, in the same way the qualities of the eyes are known because of the manas. And it says, sankalpayet manaha. Manaha, manas. The mind, sankalpayet, in this case it means understands. The mind understands, cognizes. That's a nice translation. The manas, mind, sankalpayet, cognizes all of the qualities of the eyes. And further, that mind is cha ekadha, one. So one mind. How many minds do you have in your own experience? I know psychologists will talk about this multiple personality stuff, but that's not your experience. You experience yourself as having one mind, one personality, ekada. That's interesting, because we had many external objects known by one eye, but then we have many qualities of the eye, right? Many qualities of the eye, like blindness, weakness, and sharpness, which are known by one mind. With reference to the eyes, the world is many. With reference to the mind, senses are many. And we've said before that this applies not just to the eyes, and the last part of this verse says, Shrotra tvak adau yojyatam idam. Idam yojyatam, this applies, idam, this, yojyatam is applicable. This is applicable to shrotra, hearing, tvak, sense of touch, adau, etc. This applies also to our other senses of hearing, taste, touch, and smell. That applies to all. So, many external objects known by senses, many aspects of the senses known by one mind. Now, things get more interesting. Kama sankalpa sandeha, kama sankalpa sande, shraddha shraddhe dhrati tare, shraddha shraddhe dhrati, hrir dhir bhirit yevam, hrir dhir bhirit yevam adin, hrir dhir bhirit yevam adim bhasayet yekadachatihi bhasayet yekadachatihi. So different activities of the mind are also known, which is what this verse deals with. What are those activities of the mind? Activities like kama, desire. Activities like sankalpa and sandeha. Sankalpa is a decisive thought. Sandeha is a doubt. These are known to you, functions of your mind. If you want a cup of tea, you know the presence of desire. If you're sure you want a cup of tea, you know that. If you're not sure if you want a cup of tea, that's known to you, however your mind thinks. Shraddha, faith, is known to you. Ashraddha is known to you. Lack of faith, lack of belief. Dhriti, firmness, is known to you. Itra means opposite. Dhriti and itra, firmness and its opposite, all are known to you. Qualities of the mind. Also, hrihi, modesty. Dhihi, intelligence. Bhihi, fear. Iti, thus, evam adim, all such mental activities, bhasayet, bhasayati, bhasayati ekadhachatihi. All, and this verb is so important, all of these mental activities, bhasayati, it's a causal verb, are illumined. All of these mental activities are revealed, are made evident. What is it that makes evident? What is it that reveals all these activities? Ekadha chittihi. Chittihi here means consciousness. We have so many words for consciousness. In English, we mostly have two, awareness and consciousness. You wouldn't be surprised, though, that the Sanskrit language, coming from such a profoundly philosophical culture, we have many words for consciousness. Words like chit, chaitanya, chittihi, nyaptihi, jnana, and we could find a few more, I'm sure. So be ready, there are many words for consciousness. Here, chittihi. There is ekadha chittihi, one consciousness that knows all the activities of the mind. And we've come now to that third level. There are many, many qualities of the external world that can be known by one sense organ. But we have many sense organs and many capacities of those sense organs which are known by one mind. But the mind, as we understand, has many activities. How many? How many different kinds of thoughts and feelings and sensations and different mental activities, memories? Virtually infinite. And all of those many mental activities, mental activity, let's make sure we use the right word, vritti. Vritti literally means that which moves, that which changes, so activity. Dhivriti, buddhivriti, activities of the mind. Manovriti is a common expression. Manovriti, activities of the mind. These many vrittis are known by one sakshi, one witness. The commentator here goes on at some length about this one. Sometimes even oneness is examined in commentaries. There are three kinds of manyness. There are three things that can prevent something from being one. And the commentator actually goes one by one to make sure that we understand there is but one consciousness. That which makes your thoughts known is consciousness. Is there anything else making your thoughts known? What is your experience? There is nothing else making your thoughts known. Can I save you the technical details? There's a long discussion about sajatiya, vijatiya, and swagata bheda. Three kinds of differences. If there were something other than consciousness revealing your thoughts, there would then be vijatiya bheda. But there's no other thing other than consciousness revealing your thoughts. Is there a second consciousness revealing your thoughts? Do you have multiple consciousnesses observing your thoughts? No. Therefore, there's no svajatiya bheda. There's no difference of similar things. Vijatiya bheda, difference of dissimilar things. Svajatiya bheda, and this is technical stuff. If you've heard it before, it'll make sense. If you haven't heard it before, don't worry about it. It's not important. So there's no vijatiya bheda. There's nothing other than consciousness revealing thoughts. There's no svajatiya bheda. There's no second consciousness revealing your thoughts. And finally, swagata bheda. Do you have different kinds of consciousness? Actually, we're going to inquire into that quite a bit in the coming verses. Because it seems like we have different kinds of consciousness. It seems like our consciousness undergoes change. If consciousness undergoes change, it has swagata bheda. It has internal differentiation. But what we're going to see... Oh, good. We're going to make it to the next... Yeah, we're doing fine. We'll make it to the next verse. What you're going to see is that the consciousness doesn't change. And that really seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? You, the observer of all mental activities, are utterly unaffected by any mental activity you observe. Which means, when your mind is sad and depressed and miserable and just as bad as it can be, Vedanta says, it's okay. Doesn't affect you at all. Is that your ordinary experience? So that we have to inquire into. Let me, I was supposed to look at this commentary on this verse. Yeah, swagata. Svagatadi bheda rahita satchidananda lakshana brahma abhinna kutasta pratyaya rupa sarva sakshani chatihi ekada bhasayati. This is how the commentator defines this sakshi. This sakshi, which is swagata adi bheda rahita, which doesn't have these three kinds of differentiation we just discussed. There's nothing other than consciousness knowing your thoughts. There's no second consciousness knowing your thoughts. And consciousness has no... Actually, put it like this. Consciousness has no parts. No individual parts. The consciousness that knows your thoughts, is it one thing or does it have lots of parts? What is your experience? Our experience is that it is one thing without parts. Our thoughts have different parts. Our minds have lots of compartments, so to speak. But the one who knows your thoughts doesn't have internal parts or differentiation. That's a swagata bheda. So free from these three kinds of differentiation, and that consciousness is sat chit ananda lakshana. It is defined. That consciousness is defined by the words that you've heard many times, sat chit ananda. All this has to be established. We've yet to do so. We'll probably do most of that in the next verse. Sat, in this context, means real or existent, but in this context, it means unborn, uncreated, and unchanging. We have to establish all that. Sat literally means existent, but it ends up meaning unborn, uncreated, unchanging. Chit, that means consciousness. That's the essential nature. And ananda, full, complete, vast. And as you've heard me comment many times before, ananda cannot mean bliss. You get it? Based on our discussion, do you understand now why you cannot translate ananda in the expression satchit ananda? How many authors translate ananda as bliss? Almost all of them. And based on our discussion so far in the text, can you understand now why the translation bliss is so horribly inadequate? Not inadequate, incorrect, wrong. Tell me, bliss is something you experience, correct? If bliss is something you experience, it's an object known to you, sakshi, witness. Our general understanding of bliss is bliss occurs in the mind and you experience it. Why does bliss occur in the mind? Because you're seeing something or feeling something really wonderful, something from outside. This is a usual mechanism of bliss, even if it's not coming from outside, even if it's just in your mind. Bliss is a manovritti, a divritti. Bliss is an activity of your mind. It's known to you. So do you see when ananda is translated bliss? It really causes massive confusion. It can't mean bliss. Bliss is what we experience. Sakshi is not an experience, but rather the experiencer. So, Satchidananda Lakshana. Brahma Abhinna. We're going to see this towards the end of the text. This consciousness is non-separate from Brahman. This commentator, by the way, it's a sophisticated commentary. It's not an introductory thing. So he is telling you what the culminating teachings of Vedanta are. This consciousness ultimately is Brahma, Abhinna, non-separate from Brahman, the reality because of which everything exists. It is Kutastha, unchanging. It is pratyagrupa. It is in the form of something internal, that which is most inner. It is sarva sakshini, the witness, the witness of all, the observer of all mental activities. Iti chittihi. Thus is consciousness. The commentator says. All right. And we'll start this verse. We may not finish it tonight.
No deti nastam hetyesha. No deti nastam hetyesha. Navridhim yati nakshayam. Navridhim yati nak. Swayam vibhatya thanyani. Swayam vibhata thanya bhasayet sadhanam vina, bhasayet sadhanam vina.
All right. So far, it's all philosophy and psychology. Vedanta really begins with this next verse. Everything up to this point, you don't need Vedanta to discover. Any clear mind guided by some observation, guided by some proper philosophical inquiry, you could figure this out. everything that we've discussed so far. As we proceed, however, we're going to come to the unique revelations or discoveries of the rishis. So really speaking, what has transpired so far is something that you could theoretically figure out on your own. Are you likely to figure it out on your own? Perhaps not. But theoretically, you could figure that out on your own. What follows, however, is something that we need help understanding, which is why we have Shastra, scripture. And the observation here is that na udeti, na astam eti, esha. I'm just breaking the words apart. Esha, this consciousness, esha, this consciousness, na udeti, does not arise, na astam eti, nor does it set. Like the sun rises and sets, this consciousness does not rise, does not set. Now, this is counterintuitive in two ways. First way is when you sleep at night, it seems like your consciousness sets. When you wake up in the morning, it seems like your consciousness arises. And the second place that's counterintuitive is when you die, it seems that consciousness would set. And when you're reborn, if you are reborn, it seems that consciousness arises. Both are common sense. Both are wrong. And let's examine why. Some of you have been in other classes where I've discussed this, and this for me is a favorite topic, perhaps because it's one of the things I really struggled with as a student. How do you know for sure that this consciousness doesn't come and go? The commentator said that this consciousness, chittihi, this consciousness is brahma abhinna, non-separate from Brahman, and that's what the Mahavakya Tattvamasi is going to reveal. And what's beginning to be discussed in this verse is something that I've commented on many times, and that is the consciousness that's present in this experience, the consciousness that you know every day of your life, you think it's very ordinary. It's with you all the time. It's the most common thing. It's present in every experience. So therefore, since it's present all the time in all your experiences, naturally you will conclude that your consciousness is just ordinary consciousness. Well, there is another misinterpretation of experience. What we're going to see, beginning with this verse, is how the consciousness that you think is ordinary is in fact the most extraordinary reality there is. After all, the commentator said, brahma abhinna, the consciousness that you think is ordinary is not different from Brahman, the reality because of which everything exists. That's not ordinary. The reality because of which the universe exists is an extraordinary reality. The commentator says, your consciousness is non-separate, non-different from that reality. Extraordinary. But your experience says, ordinary. We need to examine that experience. This is one of many places where we misinterpret experience. We do so all the time. How many times have you been fooled by an optical illusion? Right? We get and the favorite example you've heard me give in other classes is watching the sunset. You've watched how many sunsets over the years? The correct answer, of course, is zero. Because the sun doesn't go down. The sun doesn't go around the earth. You know that very well. In fact, when you're watching the sun set, the sun is stationary in the sky. Correct? You are on a globe tilting over backwards. The sun is stationary. You are the one that's moving. Is that how we interpret it? That's the point. We constantly misinterpret experience. I have an experience of having a body. I misinterpret it. This is me. I have the experience of sadness. I misinterpret the experience. I am sad. I have the experience of consciousness. I misinterpret it. Consciousness is ordinary. So let's begin. We won't finish, but we'll start tonight. See if we can establish this first one. Your consciousness doesn't come and go. It is absolutely stable and unchanging. The first thing we have to deal with is what happens in deep sleep. And this is what I struggled with as a young student. Because we all have the experience in deep sleep of being unconscious. And then when we wake up, we have the experience of becoming conscious again. So all of us have the experience of losing consciousness and regaining consciousness, which is absolutely contrary to what this text says. Na udeti, it doesn't rise. Na astam eti, nor does it set, nor does it go away. How can we reconcile this? There's a common explanation that's given, actually in many Vedanta commentaries, an explanation which, in my view, is horribly inadequate. The usual explanation given is when you wake up, you know that you slept. That's the usual explanation. When you wake up, you know that you slept. So it means you must have been present to know that you were sleeping. This is given in so many Vedanta books, and this is what really made me struggle as a young student. It's logically incorrect. When you wake up, do you know for a fact that you slept? How do you know? While you were in deep sleep, you weren't having any experience. That's our definition of deep sleep, right? Deep sleep, dreamless sleep, is a condition of no experience, unconsciousness. But this common explanation says, when you wake up, you know that you didn't experience anything. You know that there was an absence of experience, and therefore you must have been conscious of the absence of experience. I see eyes glazing over. Because it turns out, and it's okay, it turns out it's a complex issue and it's a logical fallacy. It's any freshman in a logic class can actually dismiss that kind of argument. You cannot make an argument based on absence. I can't say that because there's no apple in my hand, therefore, is that a valid argument? Because there's no apple in my hand, therefore, one of the basic rules of logic is you can't argue on absences, on negatives. And this is a common logical fallacy. That's what you learn in a college classroom. This is not a college classroom. We'll set that aside. Just suffice it to say that when you hear that argument, it turns out to be logically invalid. I have a much better... I'm looking at the clock. I have a much better way of explaining, and it's going to take longer than we have time in this class. So I'm going to wrap up the class in a different way. Suppose we've made wrong interpretations of our experience of being conscious beings. Our basic experience is that you are conscious of what's happening in your mind. Notice we've reframed. Usually people would say your basic experience is that you are conscious of what's happening in the world. We've reframed that, right? For obvious reasons. We've just been through this. So your fundamental experience is of the contents of your own mind, the activities of your own mind. So basic experience is you are the sakshi, the witness of the vrittis, of the activities of your own mind. But in that very basic experience, we make many wrong interpretations. First wrong interpretation we just discussed, that this consciousness comes and goes. And we're going to discuss in the next class that your consciousness doesn't come and go, which means you are as conscious in deep sleep as you are right now. Assuming you're awake right now. Sorry. Okay. We're also going to discover how when you were born, your consciousness did not begin. When you die, your consciousness won't cease. We have to establish all this. But it shows some of the wrong conclusions we've made about our experience of being conscious beings aware of mental activities. Other wrong conclusions is you think that whatever happens in your mind really affects you. That is, when there's sadness and depression in your mind, it seems to rub off on consciousness. Feels like it. When you're really happy, do you say, oh, my mind is so happy? You don't say that. That's not what you feel. You feel happy. I am happy. Well, it turns out there's another misinterpretation there. And even the... This is all things we're going to see next class. Another good example of misinterpretation of experience is consciousness is here within the confines of this body. That's what we experience, right? If you touch the chair, I don't feel it. If you touch here, I feel it. Therefore, my consciousness is here. My consciousness is not there. But then it gets a little bit arbitrary. Where exactly does consciousness, where is the envelope, the limit, the edge of consciousness? So it's here, it's here, it's here, and then you come to the fingernail. So somehow consciousness is in the skin, but it's not in the fingernail? Isn't it sounding a little arbitrary? Consciousness is on the head, but it's not in the hair? Something sounds odd with that. That's another misinterpretation of experience. We're going to find out that your consciousness doesn't come and go. We're going to find out that your consciousness is utterly unchanging and therefore not affected by any experience whatsoever. And we're going to find out that your consciousness doesn't have a physical edge or boundary or limit, therefore is limitless, ananta. What Vedanta teaches is contradicted not by experience. What Vedanta teaches is contradicted by our misinterpretation of experience. So what we're going to do in the coming classes is continue to examine our misinterpretations of our experience of being conscious beings, aware of our minds, and when these misinterpretations are cleared away, you end up understanding Satchitananda Atma, Atma, true self. You end up with a definition of Atma which is not different than the definition of Brahman. Atma, ultimately is Brahman. He said, Brahma abhinna, your chittihi, your consciousness, is non-different from that Brahman. The only way to discover that truth, though, is to remove all these misinterpretations. That's what we'll do in our next class. Good. We'll conclude here. And if you have questions, you can join us this coming Sunday at 6 p.m. We'll have satsang question answer, and you can take up your questions at that time. Saturday programs will be as normal. And we'll conclude with our brief prayers.